This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, Smithers Brewing Company, only 7 years old this year, was awarded Canadian Brewery of the Year at the Canadian Brewing Awards in Vancouver last week, where the very best in craft breweries across the country gather to have their beer judged by a panel of industry experts. This year's competition featured more than 1,600 entries from nearly 270 breweries, spanning 50 categories from traditional English ale to spicier offerings like chili beer. Smithers Brewing Company won bronze in the Irish Stout category, silvers in the Creative, Scotch Ale, and Berliner Weisse and Gose category, and two golds came home to Smithers in the Irish Red as well as English Mild and Brown Ale category. Here's Smithers Brewing Company's head brewer, Cam McKeegan, talking to CICK News last Tuesday.
We didn't figure out, like, until at the gala when the awards were being doled out, one of the organizers pulled me aside and he's like, "Have you figured it out yet?" Like, "No, figured one out." And, "Brewery of the Year, do you have a speech ready?" I'm like, "Do I have a what?" My name's Cam McKeegan. I am the head brewer and part owner of Smithers Brewing Company.
Okay, Canadian Brewery of the Year. What do you think that this does for, one, the brewery, and then two, for Smithers to bring home a title like that?
I mean, for the brewery, it kind of puts us on the craft beer map. Us and a lot of our friends up here are often overlooked in the craft beer scene just because we're so damn hard to get to.
Yeah.
So it does kind of, like, at the very least, there are a lot of people around Canada right now and in BC, you know, looking at Google Maps and being like, "Oh, that's where Smithers is." But I don't know, just kind of like, both for the town and for the brewery, it sort of just puts us on the map. And for the town, it does it about a week after Tony Hawk was here. So it's just like, all of a sudden people are not only going to be Googling where is Smithers, but they're like, "What are they doing up there?"
How likely did you think it was going to be that you were going to, was it six?
It was six medals. And the Brewery of the Year is just, like, it goes to the brewery that brings home the most individual medals. So, like, we didn't know we'd won six. So we didn't go into it kind of like, "Oh, yeah, I think we got this in the bag." The Canadian Brewing Awards, they kind of give you the nod. And they're sort of like, "Hey, it would be a good idea for you to attend. And also, if you could bring a couple of these beers," and they list the beers, it would be like, you know, it would be beneficial. We'd really appreciate it if you could bring some of these beers for us all to drink. And so that kind of tells you that, like, those beers have won awards, but they kind of didn't give us much more than that. We didn't figure out, like, until at the gala when the awards were being doled out, one of the organizers pulled me aside and he's like, "Have you figured it out yet?" Like, "No, figured what out?" And, "Brewery of the Year, do you have a speech ready?" I'm like, "Do I have a what?" He's like, "Oh, well, we're going to announce it in like 20 minutes. So, like, you better start working on your speech."
So, the beers that you won for, were they mostly like traditional styles? What's the secret to crafting something beautifully that a lot of people know what it tastes like and what it should taste like?
I mean, the thing with those beers is it kind of isn't a secret. Like, a handful of those styles have been around for well over a century, some of them longer than that. And they're recipes of the big breweries that have, like, that are famous for producing those styles are readily available on the internet. And it's more just kind of technique and process and, you know, sourcing the ingredients from the places where, you know, like, that the beer is from. Like, our Irish Red and our Irish Stout both won medals in this recent one, and we bring in malt from the British Isles, we bring in hops from the British Isles, right? And we adjust our water profile to be more or less like, I use cork water. I don't use Dublin water. Cork, for those of you who aren't sure, Cork is a county in Ireland, as well as a city in Ireland. I don't put actual corks in the water. It is just like taking the time, doing the research, getting the fine details right, and going through enough of the research where, you know, I didn't just copy and paste a recipe for any of these beers. It was just going through the research and finding the respected brewers who had, like, put literature on the internet and kind of synthesizing my own take on everything that's already out there. as far as, like, you know, we're kind of known in the industry as, or like in our little corner of the industry as kind of like beer lunatics, and like we're doing, you know, weird stuff. Sorry. And you know, my philosophy with that has always been, well, learn how to do the base beer properly first, and then, you know, once you've got the base beer that tasting a certain way and you're happy with it, what else works on top of or in conjunction with the flavors of that base beer. And so even our wildest stuff has a good foundation underneath it, and that's the stuff that we advertise a little bit more and we bring to beer festivals and stuff. Like, that reputation is well earned. Like, we try and be a bit weird about things, but I am pretty happy that 5 of the 6 medals were for traditional styles, because it kind of showcases the other side of our brewery, which is when we want to take a run at something that's very well established, we look at the style guidelines. We taste the beers from the breweries that made those styles famous, and we, you know, we let that inform how the beer is going to go here moving forward.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
BC Hydro is investing a lot of time and energy into a proposed second line to power the Northwest's industry projects. It's called the North Coast Transmission Line. This project has some environmental groups concerned about the assessment permitting process, which the BC Energy Regulator, quote, streamlined in order to exempt selected projects from standard environmental reviews. I attended the BC Hydro Open House on Tuesday, June 17th at the Prestige Hudson Bay Lodge, where the public could voice their concerns and ask questions to BC Hydro employees. The North Coast Transmission Line Phase 1 is from Prince George to Glenannan, and Phase 2 is Glenannan to Terrace, which affects us in the Bulkley Valley. I spoke to a man who owns a 500-acre beef farm along the existing line in Walcott, which BC Hydro owns 20 acres of for their existing line and capacitor. He wanted clarity on the options BC Hydro is proposing for this line. He felt that BC Hydro were going to move ahead with the north option, and that showing both options is a facade because they have their minds made up already. If you missed attending this open house and you have questions to ask, you still have time to voice your concerns and questions at a virtual open house on Monday, June 23rd and Tuesday, June 24th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Register by emailing projects@bchydro.com by June 22nd.
Hi, I'm Siobhan Jackson with BC Hydro.
Okay.
And Deborah Lamash with BC Hydro.
We're in the planning phase for a second transmission line, generally to parallel the existing line we have between Prince George and Terrace. And we are in the planning phase, which means we're completing our route selection, design, environmental work on the ground, and preparing to move into construction, hopefully in 2026. A transmission line moves power from one part of the province to another. In this case, because we have a single line from Prince George to Terrace, if there's an outage along that line, as there was last week, it can take out the power for everything on the other side of that when we have a single line. This will twin that line, so that will improve reliability for outages that might take place on the transmission line. For rural residents, probably a lot of the outages they experience on a regular basis are from the distribution system, so maybe a tree or some sort of interruption at the local level. So this line won't have an impact on those types of outages, but for example, outages like last week perhaps might have been mitigated by having a second line. So we are able to serve more customers out of any substation between Prince George and Terrace and beyond Terrace. So we do know through our discussions with customers that there is a demand for more industrial power in the region, but these lines are also at capacity. They're full for really most other purposes as well, for residential and commercial customers. So we'll be able to serve all customers in the region through the additional power that will be transmitted out of the system and all the way to Terrace.
What are some of the questions that you're getting in these open houses?
We've had quite a wide range of questions. A lot of people are interested in just an overview of the project, our schedule, the timing. People who are property owners are obviously interested in potential impacts to their property. I think those are the main interests we've had so far.
Oh, and that's really, because I think I read that it was 101, is it like 101 residences that there's going to be construction on their property? Is that right?
I'm not sure the exact number along the line, but generally, as Siobhan had mentioned, we're twinning the existing lines. So if people have a line on their property right now, there's the possibility that we will be working on their property as part of this project. And we're contacting property owners as we are advancing the project so that they're fully aware of what will be happening on their properties.
In most cases, it would be a right-of-way, so a transmission line or maybe a line over top of their property. In most cases, it is not likely to affect residences or buildings.
What is actually the distance between the two, from the existing to this new one?
So each right-of-way needs about 60 meters in width. So it's generally doubling what folks will see on the ground now. They'll be having as much again beside it. So another 60 meters of right-of-way.
Okay. So Bill 14, can you explain how this new legislature for BC's energy regulator, how does it benefit this project?
Sure. So the BC Energy Regulator is an agency that receives permit applications and issues permits. It issues it under the same legislation as going to the other departments in the government. So it's the same permits. One thing that's different about it that I think will benefit is because this is a very long transmission line, 450 kilometers, we'll be dealing with one entity and not different regional ministry departments. And so we'll have more consistency with respect to how those permits are processed, and we won't have some of the regional differences. But at the end of the day, it's the same legislation, it's the same permits that are required, but it'll be some of how they process it that's more reflective of a long linear infrastructure project that we think will be the benefit.
Is that a question that you're getting a lot?
People are curious about what it means, yeah. So I think there's maybe not a lot of understanding that it is still the same permits. We're not getting fewer permits. The legislation behind that, under the Land Act or the Water Act or the Wildlife Act, for example, are all the same legislation. So we'll still be permitted and following the same regulations and requirements.
This project boasts itself clean energy to power operations and reduce greenhouse gases, but how are you responding to questions about conflict of interest to make also oil and gas projects just as easily streamlined that aren't and meeting environmental requirements by 2030?
The legislative changes that are applying to this transmission line aren't changing any of the permitting or requirements for the projects that may be powered by this transmission line. BC Energy Regulator is already the regulator for those types of projects, and the environmental assessment terms and conditions that have been set for any projects that are in that process won't be affected by how this transmission line project receives its permits.
The amendments to Bill 14, the Renewable Energy Projects Streamlined Permitting Act, will leverage the BC Energy Regulator's linear infrastructure to create a one-window lifecycle regulation to expedite the permitting, approval, and construction of the North Coast Transmission Line. The Energy Resource Activity Act enables the BC Energy Regulator to act as a one-window regulator by giving it responsibility for provincial authorizations required for oil, gas, hydrogen, ammonia, and methanol activities, and overseeing exploration, development, operations, and restoration.
Are you seeing a large First Nations representation at these open houses, and how do you feel like you've been interacting with First Nations communities that are also going to be affected by the new line?
We have members of all communities who come to the open houses. We also have held meetings specifically in First Nation communities when they've welcomed us to do so. And we are consulting with nations all the way along the route. So there's been a lot of opportunity for nations to participate in different ways and whatever way they're most preferred.
BC Hydro's open house storyboards state that the company is working to implement the BC government's commitment to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, or UNDRIP, and that they are exploring co-ownership of new transmission lines with Indigenous partners. I spoke to Charlotte Uverman of the Wet'suwet'en community in Houston, who said her main concern was whether or not BC Hydro planned to hire local people to do this work in 2026 when the project is slated to begin. Here's Siobhan Jackson again.
What sort of buy-in do you actually need before you can start construction from landowners or communities?
We need a right-of-way, either on private land or on Crown land, through permits for the entire length of the line. In some cases, just because of past activity or the existing assets, we may have some of those in place already, but we don't have all of them. An example is we have access roads that are already in place, which we may be able to use again for this line and avoid having to create new roads. So that's a benefit. And in that case, it also would mean that we'd have some permissions already in place. But there's substantively, we need all of the right of way, and that's part of what happens through permitting and discussions with landowners.
Yeah. Do you know roughly like a percentage of what sort of approval you have now?
I don't. Thank you both very much for taking the time to speak with me. You're welcome.
I'm Len Vanderstar. I'm a resident of the Bulkley Valley since 1989.
What are you here to learn at this open house?
I had a number of questions, and some of them are being answered, but there's some concerns that BC Hydro has to go back home with, and is, for example, why are we needing to twin lines? Okay, there is some technology out there that California is now using with regards to increasing a doubling capacity in existing lines by using lighter materials and so forth. And the other thing is that this whole project is here to serve mining development and LNG, and we have issues around that. So if we want to create economic prosperity, instead of mining more and exporting our ore, our exporting our LNG, which is probably one of the best fuels we have in the world. We have 10,000 years of supply in Canada, and we want to liquidate it in, what, 60, 80 years? All I'm seeing is we're just so rushed to export all this stuff when we could actually have better economic prosperity by looking back and saying, wait a minute, how can we better utilize this material? So the question is, who's paying for this?
Yep.
So that question was answered to some extent, because it's a combination. If the proponents behind these projects don't pay up front, there's certain criteria around capacities or whatever, then they pay by a user fee. So eventually, BC Hydro is confident that it's cost recovery, just like when you pay Hydro a bill or whatever they put the line in. So they're assuring me that at some point, it's cost recovery. The other thing I'm looking at is that we're looking at more linear corridors, more deforestation, more habitat loss, more predator-facilitated access to vulnerable species like caribou and the talquas. We're looking at those concerns and how we could best mitigate and minimize that. So I have a lot of questions around that as well.
Yeah.
And we're going through special management zones and that. They're getting more information from this open house from people that have done some more looking into options.
Yeah.
So right now it's fairly open-ended.
Yeah.
But this definitely looks like one of these ticket items are going to go through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As part of a grassroots organization, were you ever consulted to speak on concerns, environmental concerns?
I'm with the Bulkley Valley Communities Coalition.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we're always here to ensure that we have a prosperous, healthy environment and a responsible economy. Yeah. So yeah, we're always keeping an eye on development proposals and looking at making some comments or raising questions of uncertainty that we need answers for.
Yeah. Actually, do you live in Talca?
No, I always say I'm a resident of the Bulkley Valley because I live in Recorade all through the valley.
Yeah, right? I was just wondering about the Talca substation and what that will be like for interruption or what that's going to be for disrupting, actually.
Yeah, they're going to increase capacity of that substation for sure while it's still operating. It's a little complicated, too, that why they want to twin the lines is because if you're going to upgrade a line, okay, you have to shut down the electricity for that line, so it's going to be disruptive. So you can, with their systems that they're currently using right now, is like they want to twin the line because they don't want to cause disruption, right? But it's just another wider or another linear corridor. It's just it's another one on top of another one, right? Mm-hmm. So we have enough of them as is, and they keep expanding, so we have to be conscientious around that. And we don't want to see what's happened with the Northwest one where they had all that wood along the side of the road. And it should be the cost of business instead of burning it. Like that, even if it's going to cost more, then it should be, you're burning jobs, you're burning employment around the mills. We should be utilizing the stuff. So if we're going to do it, let's look at full utilization of what we're doing out here.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lesson learned from the Northwest transmission line. We don't want to see that repeated.
Yeah.
So I voiced some concerns around that as well. But yeah, if we're going to, we're going to knock it down and let's use it and let's minimize our knockdown.
Len is referring here to BC Hydro's 340-kilometer long route of its northwest transmission line north of Terrace, which cost just over $400 million that was completed in 2012. In order to build the line, BC Hydro cut down and burned around 490,000 cubic meters of wood that was cut and cleared. BC Hydro's vice president of project and program delivery at the time, Bruce Barrett, was quoted in Global News as saying that BC Hydro could not find markets interested in that wood. I mentioned it at the top of this news story, but if you missed the open house and you want to ask questions or meet with BC Hydro employees, you still have time with two online open houses on Monday, June 23rd and Tuesday, June 24th from 6:30 until 8 p.m. And you can register for those virtual open houses by emailing projects@bchydro.com by June 22nd. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.